Exactly 1 year ago, scientists published the sequence to a then largely unknown virus. The researchers who put the genetic code for COVID online had no idea back then that the new novel coronavirus would soon take over the world. Professor Eddie Holmes is an evolutionary biologist and virologist and an ARC Australian Laureate Fellow at the University of Sydney. He co-authored the paper that mapped the virus's genome. Eddie Holmes, welcome to RN Breakfast.
Morning, Sally.
When you first had a look at this genetic code, did you know that it was big trouble right from when you saw it?
We knew it was trouble. I don't think we knew it was big trouble. As soon as we saw it, we saw the sequence, we could tell that it was very closely related to the first SARS virus that appeared in 2003, people may remember. Then infected about 8,000 people in a few countries. So we knew it was like that. And at the time, I thought, okay, this is a SARS-like thing back again. It may be the same sort of thing, may infect, maybe a local outbreak, may spread to a few countries, may infect a few thousand people. I expected some fatalities, but we didn't at that point think it was going to go pandemic. No, not at all.
And the sequencing and the publication of the paper all happened within a week. How important was speed at that stage?
Oh, it was hugely important. I think that's one of the great success stories of this particular epidemic so far, is that when the sequences arrived in the laboratory of my colleague in China, it took them 40 hours to identify the virus, 40 hours. In comparison, wind back 30 years, it took 2 years to find out the virus that caused AIDS was HIV, 2 years. So an amazing difference in speed. So, and once we had the sequence, we were really trying to get it out as quickly as possible. There are various pressures on us not to do that. But we felt under scientific kind of moral obligation to try and release it as quickly as possible and share data. And that's one of the great thing you learn from this, is it's really absolutely vital in pandemics, just to share data as rapidly as possible. I hope that lesson goes forward for future pandemics as well.
What kind of pressure were you under not to get this information out?
Well, I can't talk in detail about it, but my colleagues in China, so obviously it's a very different situation there than it is in Australia, and there were various constraints that they were under, which made it slightly tense for them. So that, and I can't say too much because there are people involved, but it was that we were in a kind of slightly different environment than we are in the West.
In those early days, can you take us inside what that feels like at those early stages? There must be a huge sense of responsibility and curiosity and scientific focus on what's going on, but a big sense of trying to get this information out.
Yeah, it was nerve-wracking, exciting, worrisome, burdensome, all those things kind of combined. And again, it's important to remember this is the first week of January or so a year ago. I mean, there were tens of cases at that point. I think the first death was about a year ago today as well. So it was a very different thing. And we were just really focused on getting this done as quickly as possible. So we wrote a paper in basically 2 days. And the sequence, as I said, came out in 40 hours. And as that week wore on, there was a week from basically the first sequence to when I released it. As that week wore on, there was interest began. So you could hear it, not just the scientists, but more the general media started getting interested in this particular outbreak in Wuhan. So just as that week wore on, the pressure mounted. And I felt a great responsibility to try and get this out as quickly as I possibly could, which eventually we did. And the great thing was that after that sequence was released, within that weekend it came out, Moderna and Pfizer, the companies in the US, they used that sequence to design these mRNA vaccines that revolutionized vaccines, and that we're going to use Pfizer in Australia and other countries in the same one. So that was a really gratifying thing that's happened because of the release of that sequence.
And Eddie, when you're talking about the sequencing, what do you see? What is that?
So what you do, you when you have your sample, when you sequence it, you try and find what microbes in an individual. We found that this particular individual had this RNA virus, and the sequence is the genetic code of that virus. And what it is, it's just a string of nucleotides or letters, in this case of RNA. And SARS-CoV-2 virus has about 30,000 of these letters, so four letters arranged in a particular order. And that's the blueprint of its genome. So humans have about 3 billion of these, and a virus is very simple, it's about 30,000. But 30,000 is enough to encode all these proteins and structures that are giving us a lot of trouble. And so once you have that sequence, what you can then do is compare it to other sequences of other viruses. And that gives you great clues as to where it comes from and what its function might be. So immediately we have that sequence, we could compare it to all the other viruses out there. We can say, oh yes, it looks like a SARS virus, it's got that gene there, that might do that, that gene might do that. So it's absolutely the fundamental information. You don't get any more fundamental than the genetic code. And that really allowed, as I say, the first vaccines to be developed, and also the first genetic test. So within a couple of weeks of our sequence being published, the first what's called a PCR test, a test we still use today to see whether you're infected, that was developed as well. So it was an important moment.
Eddie, what do we know about COVID now that we didn't know a year ago?
I think the key thing that makes it different, as I said a few minutes ago, at the time we thought it'd be like the first SARS virus, may infect a few thousand people. And I think the assumption that we had then, which turned out to be wrong, was like the first SARS virus, people would only transmit. So if you're feeling sick, you're shedding virus, you're not feeling very well. And that's what the first SARS virus did. That allowed it to be controlled quite easily because you can see who's infected quite quickly. And you can kind of ring fence those people and take them out of the transmission chain. This virus is different. This is a big thing that we've learned, is that people transmit asymptomatically or pre-symptomatically. And that's the kind of this silent spreader. And that's your worst case scenario because you don't know who's infected. And so this insidiously spreads through the population, allowing it to the population, the virus to spread much quicker and to get into locations very rapidly. And that's been the biggest thing that I think that's changed why this virus is so bad. Other than that, I think the big thing that's happened, I think, to me is the speed of the vaccine. This is not about the virus itself, but the speed of vaccination development has been pretty spectacular, particularly these mRNA vaccines, which is really an absolute game changer.
This has been your professional world for a long time, and this reality's been in front of you for a long time. Has the rest of the world caught up that pandemics aren't science fiction? This is something we need to prepare for very, very seriously.
Yeah, no, it is. And I don't want to kind of alarm your listeners at 27 on a Monday morning, but we're going to get more of these, okay? And so these are not once in 100 years events. So we have, COVID-19, 2020, we had 1918, 1919, 300 years ago. We're not going to wait 100 years for the next one. Okay, it could be 50 years, 20 years, 10 years, 2 years. It's hard to say. And the point is, the way we live today, the way we interact with wildlife, the way that we travel so rapidly, used to travel so rapidly and so widespread, the way our cities are so big and growing, the way we have deforestation, climate change, they all fuel pandemics. These things will happen again. And so we absolutely have to learn from this catastrophic event we've all dealt with over the last year. Learn what works, what doesn't work, and prepare ourselves for the next one. And there's no need to kind of overly panic, but I think structures need to be put in place, research needs to go ahead, money needs to be directed particularly in key areas of research and prevention and surveillance to stop this thing happening again. It can be done, but we have to learn those lessons globally.
Well, it's certainly something that's focused everyone's attention given what's happened over the past 12 months. Professor Eddie Holmes, thank you so much for taking us inside your work and some of the insights into what was happening a year ago. Thanks for joining us on RN Breakfast.
My pleasure, Sally.